Welcome to the MedTech Talk podcast. This is your host, Jeff Pardo, and for this month's episode, I'm thrilled to have Jane Chow, co-founder and CEO of Ceribell, joining us. Ceribell is one of the most exciting high-growth MedTech companies today and is changing the way we think about EEGs and neuromonitoring. Jane is one of those unique leaders who's been able to take a company from the early concept stages into the growth phase of commercialization. As we will explore today, Jane is also unique in that her background has combined both science and artistic expression. Jane, it's such a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
Well, a place I always like to start, particularly with entrepreneurs, because I think your stories are so fascinating as to, you know, how entrepreneurs end up in the medtech field is really going way back into sort of your childhood and what it was like growing up, what your interests were growing up, and any early indicators that there were that you might be headed in a scientific or medical direction.
Yeah, mine's probably not a straight line. So I grew up in a working class modest family in China. And when I was a kid, nobody in the family is really in medicine. So when I was a kid, I was just really interested in numbers and solving problems, mostly math problems. So my world was pretty small. The biggest dream I had was to be able to go to college, will be the first one in my family. The turning point, I would say, probably that's the change, the trajectory was when I was 14. That's when the Minister of China Education decided to select about 100 kids across the country focused on science. So I remember passing all these exams and was selected and took an 18-hour train to Beijing, starting my high school there. So then I really was, it's like a kid in the candy store. That I was really giving the best education in the country to study just science. That's when I really discovered I loved chemistry. There's this combination. Now I can think back. At the time, it wasn't clear. There's just a combination of rigorous thinking, the scientific part, and just the natural beauty of the molecules. And I just love drawing molecules. So I got into chemistry, and at the time, China was very big into this international Olympiads. So each year, there are four kids presenting each country. It was big national pride tied to that. And I think I was selected. I was one of the kids selected, one out of the four. I think I was probably the only girl selected in 10 years. So those are kind of the turning point, make me realize, like the world is actually so much bigger, and there's something fascinating about just science and chemistry and what I can do with it.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. And from there, did you go straight to the U.S. to continue your studies, or what was the next step for you?
I went to college still in China, to Beijing University, and studied chemistry.
Yeah.
And yeah. So then I came to the U.S. for my PhD.
Okay.
Back in 2001. Yeah.
And what was that like? It sounds like you had some exposure to the international travel at least, but what was it like coming to the U.S.? And I think you landed it in Cornell, which was Ithaca, New York, which must have been quite a change.
That's right. My first stop, so I joined a tri-institutional program, so it's Cornell, Rockefeller, and Sloan Kettering. So the first 2 months was in New York City. Mm-hmm. And coming from Beijing, I told my mom, I was like, oh, it's similar. It's this big, different language. Of course, there's a lot of difference, but I didn't feel until I landed in Ithaca. I was like, oh, wow, this is really different. I loved the experience, though. They're a big part of course, just doing science and really learn so much. And it's also, there are just a lot of things I'm learning about just culture and interacting with a hugely diversified group, right? Which is my classmates coming from all over the world. Yeah.
Yeah. And there you were actually studying biophysics, if I understand it correctly. And what was the shift from chemistry to biophysics?
Yeah, I always, later when I think about it, it might be a theme, is this curiosity across different disciplines. It's this cross-disciplinary thing. I chose this PhD program, this tri-institutional program, because it was designed to find chemists to explore biology and biophysics. So that's how the program was designed. So then they purposefully recruited researchers from medical school, from this Sloan Kettering Cancer Research, to Rockefeller, which is very bio-focused, to Cornell, which is a lot of chemistry and physics. At the time, I chose the program because partially I feel chemistry has been around for hundreds of years to make a real meaningful change, and discovery feels harder and harder the more I learned about it. And this was 20 years ago. Biology, especially molecular biology, was just exploding, right? There are so many things we don't know. And I was just so intrigued that how to use all the training I had in chemistry and have a very unique perspective to look into this area that's growing whether or not I can find new discoveries, right? And I used to joke that I talk to a physicist, say, hey, I'm a biologist. When I see a biology major, say, oh, I'm a chemist, and the other way around. Yeah.
Well, it really must. I mean, just having that sort of, you know, diversity of experiences, I mean, it really must. I think that's kind of the root of innovation sometimes, right? Is that when you're training in different things, you just see things from different perspectives.
100%. Even I would say my PhD thesis was about the protein structure. I don't want to get too much detail. So on surface is bio, but the mechanism of the protein-protein interaction, it was a very unique chemist perspective on how things work, right? And that your brain goes this ding when you connect the two dots that's so far apart, that sometimes the dots other people cannot see because they didn't have that training and experience.
And then we get to, I think, one of the real fascinating sort of parts of your journey is what I mentioned in the opening, kind of the artistic expression. And I mean, first of all, very few people I feel like can really effectively utilize both sides of their brain to combine science and art. But tell us a little bit about the work that you did in cinematography and directing and kind of how you got into that. And also, you know, the impact that it had on you.
Yeah, candidly, it was more, I was very lost. So I always thought for years when I studied science, chemistry, biophysics, I thought that I would be a researcher or faculty somewhere doing research. That's how I always see myself. And almost more than halfway of my PhD, I realized I didn't want that. And I couldn't articulate why, but I knew something was missing. So as I finished my PhD, I stepped back and asked myself, what do I really truly love and passionate about, right? If I just don't think about career, just what's my passion? And believe it or not, at the time I was 25, like I think it's film. I thought, okay, I grew up in this very strict science training Chinese educational system. What if I have so much talent in art that I never explored? And I loved movie because I feel, again, this a little bit cross-disciplinary, is all the art form in some way can be represented there, from music to storytelling to visual, right? Literally, I call it my early mid-age crisis. I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I was like, let's give this a shot. I borrowed $6,000 from a friend of mine. I'm not like from this rich family that I wanted to do 1 year. I genuinely believe that I might switch my career after a PhD in biophysics to become a filmmaker. So my plan was to go. So I went to Beijing Film Academy. My plan was to build my portfolio and then come back to the US, apply for a film school. That plan obviously didn't pan out because it was such a fun experience. But halfway, I realized I really miss this rational thinking. Like my science brain started to scream at me, say, hey, like this is a lot of emotional and artistic things. So that's why I came back. But the biggest learning for me, besides, you know, interacting with completely different group of people, mostly filmmakers and artists, is this empathy. I mostly worked on documentaries in film school. And for me, the essence of making a documentary is to look at the world from others' perspective. right? So I was, for instance, I was working with some just immigrating workers in Beijing, and just because they are almost transparent. They are everywhere in Beijing, this big city. They build the whole city for people live there, and people don't see them. Mm-hmm. So I was going to their shelters and just trying to think, what's it like? And just to bring the side that we cannot see because we live in a different world and completely different perspective, right? I don't know why I did that. It's just purely curiosity.
Yeah.
And it was so rewarding when you are able to connect with another person that you would never be able to connect from a different in different circumstances. And I think till today, that's probably a big part I really benefited about is empathy and how to see other people's perspective naturally come to me.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I mean, I think about that all the time when if I'm, you know, walking around the city, or everybody's got their own story. You know, every person you pass has their own story, and like being open to learning about people is, you know, it's I think it's fascinating. And I'm curious, you know, as you begin to transition back into business. Because we talked a little bit previously about connections and just the ability to make connections with people. And I imagine that, you know, just delving into that artistic world, and particularly in the sort of documentaries you were doing, sort of enhanced your ability or opened up your ability to sort of make connections, where had you been in a lab or whatever, maybe that becomes stunted in a way.
I think so. It definitely nurtured me. And naturally, to your point, I always wonder, what's this person's story? And there's often always some overlap between two people's story, no matter how different they are, right? So it's always fun to find that commonality to connect with people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I imagine, you know, in running Ceribell and, you know, dealing with investors and dealing with a board, I mean, having that ability to sort of see things from that person's perspective, or at least appreciate it, that must help you in your sort of effectiveness, I would imagine.
I think so. I think so. And I think it's running the company, to your point, is investors, the board, and also customers. Mm-hmm. Right. And also employees, very different functions. Mm-hmm. And if you combine all that together, internal, external, it's just very, very different personalities, trainings, background, being able to, I don't think I can, you know, really see nobody can really see other people's perspective. That's also the other humbling point I keep in mind, but just was able to switch gear and see things. That definitely helps.
Yeah. So coming out of, you know, your early life crisis, maybe we can call it, you shift back into the business world. And I think you switched to McKinsey. But I'm curious, you know, how is your thought process starting to change here? And kind of what I want to get into is ultimately, you know, the founding of Ceribell. But I'm curious what these experiences back in the, you know, in the business world start to shape you and your interests and, you know, what you ultimately want to do.
Yeah, McKinsey was just really a rewarding and fantastic experience for me. I called my paid MBA. Before McKinsey, I knew really absolutely nothing about business. To prepare the interview, I need to read what is the P&L. And as I started my job at McKinsey, I think that's in graduate school, I feel like there's something that's missing. And I start to feel, oh, maybe this is that something I was looking for. It took a rather unconventional way, a pass at McKinsey as well, because of my educational background, naturally, I should go to healthcare. I actually fight my way not to do healthcare for the first 2 years. So I did high tech, infrastructure, consumer. You name it. And because I'm just curious, I was like, this is might be my only experience opportunity to learn so broadly across so many different aspects of business. And again, coming back to running Ceribell, like all that experience many ways helped me nowadays. And another aspect of McKinsey is just this huge diversity. I worked in US and Europe and Asia. And I served sometimes large foundations in the US, Europe, of course, global companies, C-suite, the CEOs and CFOs in the US. And also in Asia, like we served some of the government ministers. So when you just think about the diversity of the projects and the different people we manage as clients, and that was really a steep learning curve for me, but really rewarding. Goes back to how you see people connect with people from completely different background.
No, that sounds like a terrific sort of education in a very practical sense, right? Not being in the classroom necessarily, but really in sort of the real world classroom. So tell us a little bit about the founding of Ceribell. And here I'm always really interested in kind of, you know, what really where it started and how it started and kind of where the idea came from. And can you walk us through that?
Yes, I'm one of the three co-founders. So the company's very early origin story comes from the other two co-founders. They're both faculties, still full-time faculties at Stanford. One is Dr. Joseph Parisi, who is a neurologist. The other is Professor Chris Schaaf. He's a musician and expert in acoustic signal. So this is probably 15 years ago, Chris and Joseph started an art project. It's turning brainwave, which is EEG, into music. So they got some funding from Stanford, and this is Stanford was trying to promote science and art. See, I keep getting to this theme. and it was a really cool art project. Got a lot of PR coverage, the music of the brain. And Yusuf, Dr. Parvizi, realized at the time the brain that had seizure sound very different than the normal brain. And so then they start to entertain the idea and also did some early work on, can they use this for medical clinical reasons? So the company at the time was called Brain Stethoscope. The idea is you almost have a stethoscope, you put on patient's head, you listen to seizure. It's a great idea. And if you look at it from business perspective, there's many challenges with it. So I met the two co-founders when they were prototyping the brain stethoscope and struggling a bit, raising money and building the company. So it's still all in research labs. And so that's when I got, initially I was just helping friends, but I really got into it. Yusuf connected me with about 20, 30 different physicians from ED doctor, ICU to neurologist. And of course, I did my McKinsey thing, interviewed everyone, map out the landscape and strategy, like what's the biggest unmet need. And I was shocked how big the unmet need was and still is in ICU. Just patient can get EEG, and it's not even rural areas, everywhere. So my initial reaction is somebody must have figured this out. It can't be this big, right? And there were about a dozen of EEG companies out there. We bought every single product we can buy. Nothing worked. Mm-hmm. Nothing worked. And that's when this like light bulb went on. It's like, there's something here. And that's also the same period that was in Genentech. Genentech failed another molecule in phase 3 on Alzheimer. And I remember I was in the pipeline. I remember in pipeline discussions, if, you know, a molecule fail in oncology, like there's so much data behind it. You know, there's, you know, which mutation worked, you know, you have all the in vitro quantitative data, right? You can look at different patient population. When this Alzheimer drug failed, there was so little. There's so little biomarker behind it, right? So, and as I just connecting the dots, it just really feel that the brain just remain a black box. And at the time, I candidly wasn't thinking about AI, and we'll talk more about future using EEG, future vital sign. No. I was just thinking patients are dying in ICU, and it just feels like this is a problem that can be solved. Can we solve it? So that's when I quit my job in Genentech, took an 80% pay cut, and started the company and built our just really amazing team. And we went from there. And it's really about 6 months as we built the team, initially only focused on the hardware. Our CTO, Ray Wu, who joined us like within the first six months. And I remember Ray and I sit down and thinking, hey, like this was about 8 years ago. Nobody was talking about AI. Like EEG is so complex. Is there something we can do, not just rely on human ears with this acoustic signal? Is there something about AI we can do? So even back then, we decided all the software, hardware decisions we make sure there will be a platform down the road we can work on it. We didn't have money to hire data scientists at the time, but it's all baby steps. It's not like the vision was so clear in day one.
That's incredible. And it strikes me that, you know, you're coming over from biotech into devices, into neuro, running a company. I mean, the amount of like learning you must have been doing at that time from kind of all sides, like how did you navigate that? How did you sort of figure out how to like bring a product through a development cycle and with all the kind of controls that you need in the medical device world and the regulatory pathway, and then who you bring on board to work with you. I mean, how did you sort of navigate all of that?
Yeah, it was really hard and really fun. I think there's a lot of my previous training, even though it's not in med tech, but actually naturally fitting, right? So my PhD training, the R&D part comes very natural to me. Then the McKinsey training, and then a lot of my work with Genentech and Novartis is in clinical trials. So the trial design, clinical regulatory, and then most of McKinsey training is in commercialization. It's not direct, but it did just kind of bring all my trainings together. Mm. However, that's far from being enough to build a company. I think the way I approach it is really twofold. One part of it is I try to talk with as many people as possible who has decades of experience on specific topics, right? So you try to learn and, of course, read. And the other fold is really I try to approach every challenge as a problem. It's like, what is the essence of the problem? Not just how did other company do it? Is what is the essence of the problem we are trying to solve? How can we answer that fundamental question? What information do we need? What pilot? What data do we need, right? Who do we need to talk to? So I think that has been probably our overall company approach now as well. It's not just say, hey, how did other people do it? It's how can we learn as much and then solve our own problem? And end of the day, I would say the most important part is what you have mentioned is finding the right people. And in earlier days, a part of Cerebell, I'm more proud of than even our product itself is our team. Our employee number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you keep naming it. They are the first 5, 6 engineer. They are all the first 5 employees. They're all engineers. They are running, they are essentially our current leadership of R&D now. Every single person is still with the company. And I still in the earlier days, my training is in science. I cannot code at all. So what I do is I realize I cannot interview candidates. I give them a little paid project. So they will do the little paid project for the company. And I wish, of course, at this scale, we cannot do that anymore. I find that as the most effective interviewing process. And once we find the right people, that's more than half of the problem. Yeah. Then the rest of it is much more fun because you have the right people. They bring their expertise. You solve the problem together. And my job, so much of it is to connect the dots. Yeah. What would the customer need and translate that to R&D and the other way around as well.
Yeah. That makes so much sense. And you make it sound easy, that last part, but I know that's like also the sort of the magic happens in being able to do that. And I love what you say about sort of finding the essence of the problem, because I think so often, you know, we think, you know, companies think about, yeah, what's the competition doing, or let's talk to our customers and find out what they need, which is, you know, there's value in that. For sure. But I think it's also a very limiting way to think about things, because sometimes customers don't always know exactly what they need until they have it, right? And sometimes you want to be transformational, so your competitors are not transforming things. So I'm curious, is that kind of what you saw as well?
No, 100%. And the customers in many ways know what they need, but if you ask them about the product, they will tell you they need a better version of the product they have, right? Because they're not the product. And then if you have a product that fit everybody's wish list, it becomes this super cumbersome product that would never be able to develop, right?
Yeah.
So and it sounds simple and easy, but it's so hard to do. Because nobody have enough information and data. When you make these huge decisions that would impact your product and the company strategy, probably it's hard to reverse for even 5-10 years. And so a lot of it is make that decision and judgment without the complete data. And I think that's the hardest part. If you think about the product design and how to find that balance. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And maybe just one thing, maybe just one thing to add there is that's where the empathy really comes in, right? Like I so believe that so much of design, I've spent a lot of time thinking, working with the team on the product, because that's really, we have the best product to save patients' life, to have the best user experience for physicians and nurses, right? That's really the core. It's a lot about what's it like to be a physician on the bedside? What's it like to be a nurse, right?
Yeah.
How they're like really maximize their experience and really maximize that empathy part. It really is a big equation as well.
Yeah. And what's it like to be a patient? Yeah. So that is absolutely right.
Yeah.
You know what? It's straight. One question I have as you're talking about that is, in coming out with a product, and it sort of brings me back to when I was a product manager at Synthes and I was releasing this product. And I remember the CEO of Synthes saying, you know, we cannot release a product that has any failure. It has to be perfect, basically, which was a pretty high standard, particularly with the product we were introducing. But I'm curious how you view that, because I find that actually a very tough way. Like perfection is the enemy of the good sometimes, and you have to get out there with a product in order to really learn like what you need. So how did you approach that in the early days of Ceribell? When was it good enough to kind of get it on the market?
Yeah, that's another one of the most core questions for any product. What's good enough?
Mm-hmm.
I think strategically, we try to be really clear about what are the features that's a category that we cannot compromise.
Mm-hmm.
And in that category, what's the ranking of each features, right? And then we have a category of, you know, these we know is not perfect yet. We're going to make it better. So we probably will talk more about our product, for instance, our headband, which really revolutionized how EEG is being set up. And we had three criteria. The number one is signal quality. That's the one thing we do not compromise. Maybe that go back to it has to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And the number two is ease of use, and that we try to be as perfect as possible, right? And the number three is patient comfort.
Mm-hmm.
And because these are ICU patients, if it's a home monitoring, you would change this different features. Mm. As you can see, you might be able to sacrifice a little bit about ease of use because at home it's less urgent. It's not in ICU and ED, but you absolutely need to maximize patient comfort. So just being really clear up front on what is we cannot compromise and what are the things we can continue to improve. And since we launched the product, we probably made dozens of small marginal improvement on just the headband alone. Like for instance, feedback. And that's another thing is the feedback, because no matter how much work you do, until you have hundreds of thousands of users tell you what's working, what's not working, because you can never have a perfect product.
Yeah.
So the user will come say, hey, your cable is not long enough. I need another device to fix it on the bed rail. So we just keep listening to our users and keep making it better.
Yeah, yeah. No, that makes so much sense. Thanks for joining me on MedTech Talk. If you enjoy the conversation, or if you have guest ideas for me, please rate the podcast at Apple Podcasts and leave your guest or topic idea in the review. I'd love to hear from you. And maybe segueing a little bit to, you know, the introduction. And I mean, there's so many uses for this, I imagine, right? You mentioned home, but even within the hospital, there's so many, as you said, where the brain is sort of poorly understood in the hospital environment, unfortunately. Did you start with kind of what you thought was really the biggest kind of pain point within the hospital as sort of your beachhead for entry, and maybe describe that a little bit, and then we can take it from there?
Yeah, the biggest unmet need in our view is getting EEG fast enough in acute care setting from ICU and ED. The reason that matters is about a third of patients in the neuro ICU would have seizure, and many in the general ICU as well. And 80 to 90% of these seizures are non-convulsive, meaning patient doesn't have symptom. And seizures is the number two neuro emergency right after stroke, right? So there's a lot of parallel there. So similar to stroke, a patient sees for a few hours, the mortality rate go up as high as 50%. And the longer a patient sees, it's harder to stop seizure. So again, similar. The early, if you treat the patient within the first 30 minutes, the seizure will stop and case closed. Right. So this early and accurate detection is absolutely critical, and guideline already requests getting EEG within the first hour because it's the only tool you can actually detect seizure, especially the 80% of seizures when patients are non-convulsive, doesn't have symptom. So the conventional EEG has been around for 80 years. And even in the best centers like Mass General, Stanford, we did trials, it took them 4 to 5 hours to get the EEG. And in majority of, I would say 80, 90% of the hospitals in the United States, it can take hours or even days because many hospitals don't have EEG during after hours. So that's where we see patients are literally dying or have major secondary brain injury because they cannot get EEG fast enough. This is in 2020. So that's where we focused all our product energy on. We made the hardware that's really easy to set up, so you don't need the EEG tech anymore. The bedside nurse can just set it up in a few minutes. So the moment the ICU doc, ED doc worry about seizure, they can get EEG right away. And then we realize it's impossible for a human neurologist to be on the bedside read immediately because there's a national shortage of neurologists. They are all super busy. And after hour coverage is the major issue. So that's how we brought in the AI, our we call it Clarity, which is our AI-based seizure detection algorithm. It perform as well for the long seizure status epilepticus. It perform as well as a human neurologist. So now on the bedside, if you worry about seizure, instead of trying to guess and wait and risk patients having, you know, hours of seizure lead to high mortality or having to empirically treat send patient to the ICU, you can get the device on in a few minutes. The algorithm in a few minutes will tell you patient have seizure, treat right away, or patient doesn't have seizure, please don't empirically treat, intubate the patient. And if you treat the patient in the conventional current standard of care, you don't know whether or not patient responded because many of these patients are in coma or non-responsive. So you have to wait for hours for neurologists to read it for you. Now the algorithm will tell you, can see the curve dropping, say, hey, patient responded, or no, your patient didn't respond to the first line medication, escalate. So that's really the big problem we're trying to solve. And there's hundreds of thousands of patients are potentially having seizures and non-convulsive seizures in acute care.
Yeah.
And that's all our commercial focus now. Now, as we get deeper into acute care, we realize it's not just seizure. I'll give you one example. Let's say if you were a surgeon and you did a major cardiac surgery and your patient doesn't wake up. Now your patient had probably 5 to 10% chance having seizure. That's why she's not waking up. Probably 0.5% chance having stroke. That's why she's not waking up. Or she's just weaning off sedation really slowly. That's why she's not waking up. Believe it or not, you don't really have a tool to differentiate. And it's completely different urgency and patient treatment pathway, right? And EEG has been proven to be biomarker for many, many of these conditions. And because when you think about it, it's really one of the richest information you can get. It's literally capturing the neuron firing signal in the scalp. But historically, we've been relying on, you know, human eyes to decode this very complex signal. And now Cerebell can use AI and this huge database we have And we can further explore, can we use this for sedation? Can we use this for delirium? And just other indications to help doctor to open this black box so they don't just manage patients' survival rate, and they can also manage patients' brain. So the life quality after patient survival ICU stay would be transformed.
Yeah. So interesting. And as you, you know, as you sort of got into this, once you made the tool available, did it just become obvious to clinicians that, you know, how they should be using it? Or how much of that did you actually have to convince them that, you know, you have to change your behavior now that, you know, now that we have this, you have to change your behavior and it's worthwhile? How much of the sort of development challenge was there from a market standpoint as you introduced this?
Yeah, there are definitely a lot of changes. As probably any disruptive technology, the word disruptive meaning we're changing how physicians have been practicing medicine for decades. Mm-hmm. It's more, it depends on the specialty as well. It's more obvious for bedside physicians who are combating this challenges day to day. Those are the intensivists, right? They make life death decisions almost every hour, and they have this sense of urgency. They need to know the answer right away. And they experience the potential delay, and many of them experience ordering an EEG and see, oh, I wonder how long patient has been in seizing. It's harder for other specialties that might not be on the bedside. And so there's a lot of, we call it changing the organizational habit. And managing ICU patient is also not a single specialty, right? It's not doing a procedural patient in the OR and out. You involve so many different specialties as well. So how do you make sure the workflow, every single step from nurse to nurse managers, to nurse practitioners, APPs, to physician, neurologists, intensivists, neuro hospitalists, the emergency docs, all work seamlessly together. So that's where definitely there's a heavy lifting on our end in supporting our physicians, and it's part of a commercialization process.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. So before we get into sort of what's ahead for Ceribell, I want to talk a little bit also going back to kind of the earlier days in attracting your initial group of investors and what that was like. I mean, you're coming into it as, you know, a first time CEO, new, you know, very new and innovative transformational technology. What were those early fundraising days like, and how challenging was that for you?
Yeah, we were very fortunate with our seed round. So we had Shanbei. I met the founder, William Dai, through a common friend of mine. And then we also had a few family and friends. Mm-hmm. So the seed round, I would say it was rather straightforward. And it was not easy because, you know, we had nothing. We just had this prototype and idea. I think the hardest round experience for me was probably our round A. That's probably a lot of investors, entrepreneurs call it the Death Valley, right? We did a bridge loan because we didn't have FDA approval yet. We just need that another $1 million to cross that. And then once you cross that, as you know, many medtech investors want to see commercialization, right? And then it's this catch 22. It's so expensive to hire Salesforce.
Yeah.
And then you don't have that money, but you have to show the sales number. I would say that's the hardest run. And I was 2 months pregnant when I was trying to raise the round A. So I walk in as a first time CEO who never worked in medtech before, who just moved back from Asia and Switzerland. And I was neuro and in diagnostics.
Yeah.
I talked with about 30 to 40 investors all stage, right? And all I got was no. And then I was 8 months pregnant. I was like, this is not good. And I literally, there's a moment I thought, this might be it. I just don't think I can raise this round. And then I met a friend of mine introduced me to this rather small fund that doesn't specialize in medtech. They actually specialize in medtech. The founder is an entrepreneur, Gary. I pitched my story to him. I still remember today. He said, you know, I don't understand medtech really well, but I believe in you and Yosef. How much money do you need? And that saved the company.
Wow. Unbelievable. Yeah. Incredible. Well, it's just, I mean, there's so much that, you know, it's like, you just got to keep trying. I mean, first of all, it's a good lesson, right? But it's like, you also never know, like, who you meet might be that person that just believes in you. And I mean, that's really comes through in that story. And also that, you know, ultimately in our business, it is about the people. I mean, the idea is obviously important, right? And kind of have to have the idea on the market, but the people make all the difference. And it sounds like that was the case. So it's interesting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think in the earlier days, if I were the investor at the time, I probably wouldn't even it's too risky, right? But then back to your point, all you need is one investor, is one person who believes in you. And if keep trying, and the time, I just feel like it's going to work out. Let's keep trying, even though there's, of course, a lot of stress and anxiety.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, your child who you're pregnant with, that must be quite a story to tell to him or her.
At some point, not yet. He's six. Yes. He heard so much of the pitch, cerebral pitch.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was scaring him.
Med tech entrepreneurship in his bones. That's great. So, you know, another thing that's interesting here is just the ability to sort of lead the company through various phases, from, you know, the conceptual development to the development of the technology to the clinical trials to the commercialization. And now you're on, you know, a terrific ramp. How challenging has it been to sort of adjust to each phase of the company? Is that felt kind of natural for you, or are there, how have you dealt with that?
Yeah, the earlier days candidly felt quite natural. Mm-hmm. I remember until we started commercialization, it was mostly R&D team. I thought, oh, I got this. I can manage people. It's like, it's all PhDs, right? Mm-hmm. And it was just people I'm familiar with for decades. And it was a fantastic group. So I said, oh, I got this. And then we started commercialization, and I had no experience, zero experience in commercialization in medtech. I didn't even do a single medtech commercialization project at McKinsey. Mm-hmm. That was a real challenge, probably the biggest both professional growth on my end, as well as for the company. I think on my end, it's the big growth for me is how to manage and connect with people who are fundamentally different who are very different from how I used to think about things, right? So I think as a McKinsey consultant, as a PhD scientist. And when you have commercial organization, especially sales organization, that's not how they think. They approach problem from people, from emotion, from connection, right? Mm-hmm. And even though I talk so much about empathy, and I didn't do well at the beginning, I was so much in the data problem solving process, mm-hmm. and really took a lot of reflection. I got a coach, actually two coaches, and I really worked through that. And I think the biggest also on the other side, on the business side, we also had very little funding to really carry the commercialization. In hindsight, I think it's a blessing. Because then I decided we only had a couple of sales team members, and I carried the bag for the first year. Mm-hmm. So Yosef, the co-founder, the neurologist, Dr. Parvizi, and I would be in many of these meetings ourselves. I worked with the supply chain, get that code. I worked, pitched to all the different physicians and administrators, talk about ROI. I trained the nurses, you know, to do the pilot, to launch the first couple of sites. So all that really educated me about what it's like to commercialize this product. So go back to what is the essence of the problem we are trying to solve. And then fundamentally, I thought, this is actually not that different from consulting. Is you go in, you try to understand that person's challenge, and you provide them with solutions, right? And that really tremendously helped us later as an organization to build up our commercialization. And later, again, it goes to people. Once we had the right sales leader, we have two phenomenal sales leaders now. And they do the job so much better than I do. And then that just that start to go really smoothly. Yeah. I mean, there's always going to be challenges as a rapidly growing company, but those are probably two of the biggest challenges I faced.
Yeah. That I think that's great. I mean, I think, you know, I think so, you know, a lot of CEOs obviously have been in the sales role, but you having actually for this company been in the position of selling, you know, and carrying the bag, as you said, I mean, must give you just, it probably gives you a lot of credibility just internally that you did that. And now you're talking to your sales force about it. But just as you've said, you know, your perspective and being able to really understand what it takes, I think that's amazing. So what is next for Ceribell? I'd love to hear kind of, you know, you're obviously having great success, and I'm sure there's a lot of running room in your initial focus in the market. But as you kind of think about what's next and the areas that you that remain kind of untapped, because you are opening up this sort of black box of the brain to I imagine lots of different interesting possibilities. What are some of the things that really excite you as you look forward?
What excites us the most is to really leverage the state of art AI tools and look into the brain, right? And would that help in the short term? Would probably what continues focus on acute care in the ICU and ED and potentially expand beyond seizure. And in the longer term, you could imagine, can we make EEG a biomarker beyond in critical care and ED settings? So we are working very hard in the back end, both in terms of building up our data science team. I would say more expanding. We have an amazing data science team. And also just proactively think about how do we better partner with our hospitals, with our physicians to collect more data so that we can, instead of running like 5-10 years prospective trial to collect this massive data you need for AI development, can we think about creative ways doing certain research retrospectively? So we are also kind of creating a new way of potential product development as well. So that's an area we're really excited about, that we hope by having a more quantitative biomarker for the brain, coming from my experience in biotech and pharma, can we also help pharmaceutical companies, biotech companies to develop certain therapies better, right? Because almost as you search many of the psychiatric or neurological disorder, you will find some research EEG is a biomarker, right? And can it help those optimization? Can it help to find specific patient target that will respond better to certain molecules? There's just completely unknown area that nobody have been able to tap into. Of course, they're all heavy lifting, would take years to come fruition, but we are working on all front right now.
Yeah. Well, it's a tragedy in the sense that as I look at like my parents' friends who are, you know, now in their 70s, 80s, the amount of neurodegeneration that takes place at that age, unfortunately, it's amazing how prevalent that is. And I think it's the thing that as we age, people fear the most. So to really be on the forefront of understanding that is going to be incredibly exciting. Well, Jane, I cannot thank you enough. It's been a fascinating discussion, and really, I think what you guys are doing is amazing. So I wish you the best of luck, and really loved having you on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Really enjoyed the discussion.